Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store or Lowe's.com for more details.
Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to MidCrimes.
The low-key bop of the century.
I'm just going to keep jiving over here.
I know. Happy Burr Months.
Oh, it's here.
It's here. I'm in my little element. The leaves are starting to change where I'm at, like just ever so slightly. And it's like really just feeding my soul. It's been amazing.
I'm hopeful. Tomorrow I have to go 3 hours north for work. And I am just hopeful that it'll just be a glimmer of more color. I'm not expecting peak. But just a glimmer? Just show me a tease.
Just some little edges. Just a little color around the edges, baby. Just a little sprinkle of magic.
Bring it on.
So we hope that... Sorry for all you people who worship the summer and are sad to see it go, but I'm excited for these next few months. I love this
Burr
season.
Months.
The Burr Months, baby. They're my fave.
Yeah, they're my fave.
Yes. We have a Patreon.
Who is it?
Her name is Abby.
Hi, Abby.
Hey, girl. Hey. And Abby, I have a creature for you. You are a leshy, and a leshy
because she's luscious, right?
Luscious leshy. So the leshy is from Slavic mythology, and it acts as a guardian of the woods and all of the animals that live in the woods. And it matches the height, like it matches its height to its surroundings. So it's as if it's among a bunch of really tall trees, it will just like casually be like, "Oh, I'm as tall as a tree." And just like be the size of a tree.
Done.
And it matches its surroundings. And it can also appear as sometimes an old man or an old woman when approached by humans in the forest, just so that it doesn't freak anybody out.
Hello, wise one.
And they can completely transform into other animals. And that is just wicked cool. So, Abby, you're a luscious leshy.
Abby the lushy.
Hell, the lushy. I love it. I think we should dive right into this bad boy because I think we should.
I don't know what we're doing, so let's do it.
Devin's in the dark.
I held the reins for the last few weeks, so now I'm ready to sit back.
Absolutely living in the DAC. So we are going to talk about the murders that happened at a VA hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan, back in the 1970s. And this, I actually knew nothing about this. And we had... It wasn't like highly requested. I got, I think, maybe one DM about this. And I was like, I actually have never heard of this and knew absolutely nothing about it. But at the time, it stole headlines. It was all everybody was talking about. And the undertones were like lots of racism, sort of the themes that are ingrained. You know, it's all like sort of in a time period where we're sort of all coming out of like World War II. And a lot of our veterans who had fought in Vietnam, you know, were being cared for at VA hospitals. And it's just interesting how all of this played out. And it was so upsetting for these two nurses who got sort of railroaded in this whole situation. So I found it really interesting and unbelievable that it went as far as it did and that all this happened. And to this day, this officially remains unsolved. And 10 people died. So this was a very, very, very big deal. And basically what happened was like in this hospital, there was this like whole bunch of respiratory arrests that all happened at once, like within a few week period. And it ended up being these two nurses who were of Filipino descent who kind of got blamed for the entire thing. And we'll get into it. But it became a very political case, and it's sort of how much this was in the media and how much it swept the nation and how political it became. It sort of echoes what I feel like went on with like the Lindsey Clancy case and like how there's such a divide and that there's so many sides to it, but it's also very nuanced. And so I just thought it was an interesting time to talk about this.
So maybe 50 years ago, had there been social media, it would have blown up.
Exactly. So let's dive in. So this starts in late July of 1975. And in the court documents that I found and in all the publications, they have actually removed the names of the victims here. And there were a lot of names of colleagues and coworkers that were also changed to like sort of protect them. So I have thrown in some names here just to be able to call them something, but just know that that's not like their real name and that's actually unreleased at this point.
Can we call one of them Abby? It's her night.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Let's not. Abby is a lushy leshy. And let's just let her have her moment in the forest. OK,
she's going to really give her her moment. That's all.
She doesn't want to be one of these people, I promise you. So this starts in late July 1975. A 61-year-old farmer checked into an Ann Arbor VA hospital, and we're going to nickname him Steve for now, okay?
So Stevie!
Steve had just undergone a thoracotomy, which is a procedure where, you know, they make a hole in the thoracic cavity, and he had a nodule on his lung and had to have that nodule removed. So that's the procedure that he underwent, and that was removed from his right lung. And Steve's surgeon came and rounded on him after the surgery, and Steve was doing well. Actually, he commented to Steve personally, like, wow, you know, you're doing amazing. Like, you're actually doing better than most patients. You know what? You might even be out of the hospital like very soon, like maybe even tomorrow. So everything was looking great. His vital signs were perfect. Now, the morning after his procedure comes and the alarms in the corridor start going off, like the monitors are starting to go off, staff kind of run into the room and they realize that it was a code blue, essentially. So all hands are on deck. Steve had evidently gone into respiratory arrest. And the clinical, you know, team of doctors and nurses, all that rushed to the bedside, they ended up having to intubate him and ventilate him. Once they were ventilating him, he did stabilize a little bit, but they had to move him to the ICU. And his, you know, things really escalated for him from there. So it was interesting because while he did have a procedure on his lung and in his thoracic cavity, it's possible that he had some kind of a complication. Like immediately the question was like, okay, well, did he drop a lung? Did he collapse his lung? Is that why he was having trouble breathing? But it wasn't like he became hypoxic and was struggling to breathe. It's that he just stopped breathing, which was very weird and unusual. So if it's not a complication from his procedure, what the hell caused this? Because does he have some kind of underlying condition that's not diagnosed? What are we not aware of? And so that's like the glaring concern. Like while, you know, we've resuscitated him, he's on the ventilator, he's doing okay right now in this moment. But what would have caused this?
I want to know.
I know. And so I used a book as a reference for this case called Paralyzing Summer. And it's by author Zibby O'Neill and S. Martin Lindenauer. A great book if you want to know more about all of this. And, you know, when the surgeon kind of reviewed everything, he's like, this surgery went perfectly. And of course, they re-imaged him and worked him up like crazy. He got another CT scan. He got x-rays. And I mean, it looked like his lung was up. He certainly did not collapse a lung. It didn't look like there was no evidence that there was some kind of procedural complication. So everybody was like, I mean, I'm at a loss. This was some kind of fluke. Something happened. Maybe it was an equipment malfunction. We don't know what happened. So He did recover pretty quickly, and they were able to take out his breathing tube one day later, and this was the morning of July 27th of 75. And he seems to be in stable condition. They weaned him off his oxygen. He's breathing on his own. He was taking short walks. He was starting to eat again. And around 5 o'clock that night, it fucking happens again. All of a sudden, everybody's flooding into the room because Steve just decided to stop breathing and he codes.
Come on, Steve.
Just like before, the alarms are going off. Medical staff rush in. They are putting another tube in his throat, re-intubating him, reconnecting him to the ventilator. And thankfully, you know, the staff was super responsive and they were able to save his life. He was on a ventilator, but he was stable on the ventilator. And all the doctors and providers are like, okay, what is going on? We have no explanation for this. He's not having an arrhythmia.
Fluff this one off. Yeah.
It's not his heart. It's not a surgical complication. What is going on? So, I mean, one unexplained respiratory arrest is weird enough, but two days after a procedure like this, it just made no sense. Like the cascade of events made no sense, especially when hours after Steve's second respiratory arrest, a different patient, who we're going to call Harry, suddenly stops breathing too. And the doctors and nurses quickly rush to his bedside. They resuscitate him. They intubate him. They stabilize him. He goes to the ICU. And
how you doing, Harry?
Just like Steve, you know, Harry does okay. He gets off the ventilator pretty quickly. He recovers quickly. He doesn't really have an explanation. Nobody has an explanation. His workup is essentially negative. And 24 hours after Harry's first respiratory arrest, he does it again. So now we have two patients who have suffered back-to-back respiratory arrests that are completely unexplained and preceded by no other events. They weren't having chest pain. They weren't ill. They weren't, like, nothing else was happening. So it was just a super bizarre occurrence to happen so very randomly to two otherwise very stable people. So they stabilize Harry. And then they realize that the guy in the neighboring room, who we're going to call Christopher, was starting to struggle to breathe.
Oh,
and within
man.
Minutes, he stops moving. He turns blue and cyanotic and is obviously not breathing. So thanks to the bedside teams, Harry and Chris, who essentially are experiencing the exact same symptoms in a very close period of time, were able to be resuscitated and ventilated. But
that's
everybody
wild.
Is kind of looking at each other like, you guys, what is going on? Now this has happened three times in one night. What
right?
the hell is going on? So there's a lot of similarities between all of these. It is way too alike. All of these presentations are way too alike to just be coincidence. So now everybody is like, okay, is there a piece of equipment that is malfunctioning? Has there been some kind of pharmacy error? Are there contaminated bags of fluid we need to worry about? We need to open a full-ass investigation because really the only thing that we can come up with is that they are being given something that they should not have. And
which means we have a whole other big-ass problem on our
exactly.
hands.
Exactly. And, like, of course the assumption is going to be that it's unintentional first, right? Because, you know, it's unthinkable that anybody would just intentionally give people something that they should not have in order to make them sicker, in order to hurt them. So everyone's like, okay, what's the problem? Because obviously there's some kind of glaring problem here where people are dying left and right, and it's causing people to become so sick that they are near death. And, like, thank God that they're here. So as we get into July 30th, just 4 days after these respiratory attacks began, around 9:30, a gentleman named John, who was being treated for end-stage kidney disease and diabetes, he was a double amputee, very sick guy, like on a good day, had some very, you know, intense comorbidities. Now,
all
of a sudden, John crashes and his heart monitor goes off, that his heart rate is slowing down, and he's hypoxic. So this time, unfortunately, despite their best efforts, resuscitation attempts were not successful.
Oh, and unfortunately, so he was the first.
Unfortunately, he died within the hour.
Sorry,
he was
John.
The first patient to die of this respiratory emergency at the Ann Arbor VA hospital that summer. And it was the beginning of just a very crazy series of events. So,
well, it's already crazy having all those colds in one night. Like,
I think that John, unfortunately, was just unlucky enough to have some pretty intense pre-existing conditions that probably, you know, he had no reserve, you know, unfortunately. It doesn't take much sometimes. So between July 26th and July 31st, a record 11 respiratory arrests took place at Ann Arbor VA Hospital.
Shit.
And that was more than they typically saw in a month. You know, that was so...
Let alone 5 days. Yeah.
So insanely above average that everybody was just really scratching their heads trying to figure out what the hell is going on. And it couldn't have come at a worse time, honestly, for the workers there, because they were desperately understaffed. And a lot of VA hospitals at the time, and even just hospitals in general, hospitals suffered from a critical shortage of all staff, mainly nurses, nursing assistants, and a lot of ancillary staff.
So that hasn't changed in 50 years.
No, I think, honestly, it was probably made a little bit worse by, you know, the war and all the fallout from that. So maybe even a little bit worse off than we are now, to be honest.
Right,
and
right.
Following World War II and the Korean War and the Vietnam War, Americans' veteran population just absolutely skyrocketed. All of a sudden, you know,
right,
the government was struggling to pay for the health care needs of all of these veterans.
Only 30 years prior was the end of World War II. So you probably have a bunch of 50-year-olds, right? Like,
yes,
when that war, 50, 60-year-olds. And then you have, you know, now people coming,
exactly,
out of Vietnam, you have the young guys, too. So,
exactly,
yeah,
the younger people, too. So they're experiencing this huge influx of veterans to care for, of patients to care for, but the staff never changed. You know, they had no increase in staffing availability. So they were just like kind of working with what they had and just trying to wade through this insane volume that they're starting to see. And to fill in these big gaps, the U.S. started accepting medically trained workers from overseas and putting them in healthcare positions in United States hospitals. And this,
I'll say that that's still in practice today, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, so maybe it started then, but yeah, we still have a lot of those,
maybe,
you know,
yeah,
different type of work programs and whatnot. And
100%.
I have to say, they're some of the best people that I've met, too.
I was just going to say, I've met
hard workers.
100%. Yeah. Cut from a different cloth. And I mean, they're just such an important part of our entire healthcare system. I think, like, if it started around now or before or just after, like, I'm so glad that it's something that continued and that we continue, yeah, to do today. Now, this programs like this kind of started to draw in staff at Ann Arbor and at other hospitals from all over the world. And actually, at the time, their chief of anesthesiology was Dr. Ann Hill, and she was born in Ireland. And
jealous.
Devin loves Ireland. She loves Ireland.
Oh, can't wait to go back.
I know. And two of their nurses, Filipina Narciso and Leonora Perez, were immigrants from the Philippines. Both Narciso and Perez were very experienced nurses back home, but at the time, certain medical professions across Southeast Asia were notoriously underpaid. Like, they would, so a lot of people,
right,
would get their licensure, then come to the States,
mm-hmm,
make a really good living, and start sending money home to their,
yes,
families.
Yes.
And we see that today.
I
too.
Was going to say that hasn't changed.
Has,
yes,
not changed. I have a good buddy that that works with me that is from the Philippines, and she is just an absolute gem, and she's holding the place together, and I love her so much. You know, these nurses had a chance to kind of like make better lives for themselves and like sort of achieve that, you know, American dream. So Perez was married to a Filipino man. She had one child, and she was, you know, really excited to start building a, like, wealth for their family and securing their future. And Narciso was a single lady, but she had dreams of marrying and maybe settling down in the United States permanently, so that, you know, she could grow a family as well alongside her career. So 29-year-old Narciso and 30-year-old Perez felt like they had just struck gold when they had found jobs within the U.S. hospital system in the early 1970s. And they both started working in the ICU of Ann Arbor VA Hospital in June of 1975. So they were busy. They were picking up a lot of extra shifts. The required overtime with how understaffed they were was really brutal.
So I think I could see where you're going with the
VA stuff.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Ooh, this is so, not going to be good.
This is exactly what stemmed everything that happened with these people. So now, despite all of the efforts from Ann Arbor to, like, keep the facility running smoothly, the VA patient numbers were growing to astronomical amounts. I mean, even with the added help, the nurses were just constantly way overworked, the ratios were outrageous. It would be, you know, people were at their breaking points. Like nurses were at their breaking points. Nurses were working shifts in a row, like 24-hour shifts in a row, going home for 8 hours, and then coming back and doing another 24. Like, it was that brutal, just trying to keep this place running. And
if I, and when I think about the evolution of hospital too, mm-hmm. I mean,
exactly.
Back in the day, they used to admit you for anything. So like, you know what I mean? So not only are you seeing the people that would be hospitalized for reasons that they would be now, right?
Yes.
But like they,
yes.
Oh, you got a UTI.
Yes.
All right. You know, like they kept him for everything inpatient 50 years ago. So
they did. They really did. Yeah. For like extended periods, too. So things have really changed.
So the volume and census load. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of what was concerning to providers when all of these respiratory arrests started happening was, OK, is somebody just undertrained? Or are nurses so exhausted that some errors are being made? Like,
right.
what, or is someone in the pharmacy making errors? Like, what is going on? Is this overworked, understaffed?
Or is this deliberate?
You know, group. Yeah, exactly. What is this? Could it be that we are way overworking these nurses and they're just making mistakes? So pretty soon, a petition actually started circulating among the floor nurses, and it read, quote, "There is a critical shortage of registered nurses at the VA hospital." The petition continued to list widely held frustrations about burnout, understaffing, patient ratios, and it was made worse by the sense that the higher-ups didn't seem to care. It was like they were just trying to you know, stem the hemorrhaging by adding a few extra staff members here and there, but it was in no way comparable to the volume of patients that they were seeing. And it became really frustrating when these concerns were being raised repeatedly to the higher-ups in the hospital and just nothing was ever changing. Like, it would just be crickets. They would hear nothing. So
it's almost like what nurses wanted 50 years ago, they still want.
It's almost like it's almost a consistent theme among healthcare workers. Holy shit.
What?
So
when the complaint doesn't change over 5 decades.
Yes, exactly. Now, while that petition was going around and while all these respiratory arrests were happening, this rumor started to circulate that, no, this was no accident. Somebody in the hospital is causing medical emergencies on purpose.
Oh, gosh.
And so at the start of August 1975, Ann Arbor VA hospital workers decided to talk to the acting chief of staff in person. Now, this was Dr. Duane Fryer. And they hoped to persuade him to please do something. You got to incentivize nurses to come and work here. We have to pay more. I don't care what you need to do, but we are understaffed and the patients are suffering. Like, something needs to change right now. And it wasn't just about burnout. What they were trying to tell him was like, yes, we're tired. Yes, we're burnt out. But like, these patients are dying and it might be because we're way overworked. We don't even know what's going on.
Right. But that could be a possibility. Yeah.
And even when there aren't respiratory arrests, like, the patients are waiting too damn long. They're getting too damn sick because healthcare is not accessible without staff. So you got to fix something. So, and then again, of course, like, with the last 6 days of July having 11 respiratory arrests and one death, something obviously had to be done. So yeah. Dr. Fryer was like, listen, I get it. I want to hire more nurses. But unfortunately, the hospital's budget was so limited because of the sheer number of veterans out there that were trying to access through VA benefits and get care. They were just put under these stringent restrictions financially. And he said, I literally have no budget. I am at the top of the budget for this hospital, which is criminal. I agree with you, but I can do nothing else. The budget is gone. It is gone to nurses, and there's nothing else I can do.
Because it's coming from the government,
yes,
essentially. That's
exactly
where his budget's coming from.
Exactly. Yeah. It's government funded. So as for the rumor that was going around that somebody was doing this intentionally, like, everybody was kind of not really taking it super seriously at first because it seemed inconceivable. Like, this is ridiculous. We are all so busy. Nobody fucking needs this. First of all, we are not all here to hurt people. None of us are here to hurt people. We're all here to help people. We like helping people. That's why we're in this industry. It doesn't make sense that somebody would do this on purpose. And also, ain't nobody got time for that. I don't even have time to pee. What do you mean? I have 12 patients and I'm an ICU nurse. What do you mean? I don't have time to breathe. I don't have time to blink. Do you think I have time to resuscitate extra people? Hell no, I do not. So that was sort of the vibe in the hospital at this time.
Right.
So now, on the evening of Saturday, August 2nd, three patients suffered a respiratory arrest before midnight. In that night
oh,
shift.
Oh, shit.
Days later, August 6th, two more respiratory arrests who ended up in the ICU. On the 8th, there was one more respiratory arrest. So chaos is starting to erupt here. This is insane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, August 12th, things just absolutely fell apart.
Gosh.
Four patients suffered from respiratory arrest. Within 2 hours. Four.
Gosh.
Within 2 hours. Every one of them survived.
Holy
Badass.
Crap.
Badass.
Wow. Kudos to that team.
I know.
Because it takes all hands on deck.
These hands are fucking busy. We do not have time for this. And then the same day, yet another patient was discovered in respiratory arrest. And he ended up, you know, it took a little bit too long for staff to get there. And he ended up going pulseless and needing to be coded. So they worked to revive the patient. And then they're hearing screaming down the hall because somebody else all of a sudden stopped breathing.
Like, what is going on?
Like, the code team is actively coding somebody else. We just don't have any other people. So a few nurses had to leave that code, go to the other room, and resuscitate this patient who was in his 40s, who was receiving resuscitative measures. He's getting like a BLS code because they don't have the equipment. They don't have the staff. Nobody is around to ventilate this guy because anesthesia is already in the other room.
Right.
Intubating somebody else. They're mouth to mouth resuscitating this guy. One of the staff members is yelling for epinephrine. They get the crash cart. They give the guy an ampule of epi. Epinephrine, if you don't know, is a drug used during codes to restore heart function. It's a very, very, you can give it through an IV bag or IV push. And if you are in some kind of cardiorespiratory arrest, it will help you regain a normal rhythm by vasoconstricting and giving some blood pressure back to you, essentially. So they're giving epi, they're trying everything that they can do with the very limited amount of people that they have to try to bring this guy back. So the crises are just like growing into this huge, mountainous, insurmountable amount of chaos.
I'm exhausted just listening at how hard they
genuinely
would have been going to
work. How do you even get in your car and drive home that night and just like crawl into bed and go to sleep? I think I would be comatose after this. This is insane. This is unimaginable. And doctors are all like, we still don't know what's causing this. And every single one of these events presented exactly the same way. Nobody had any precipitating factors. Nobody had chest pain. It wasn't anybody's heart. Their imaging is fine. They just stopped breathing. This is too much, and it cannot possibly be a coincidence. So nurses are exhausted. Like, morale is at an all-time low. It was in the shitter before, and now morale is non-existent. Everyone is like, nobody here can keep doing this, okay? We got to figure this out ASAP. So on August 14th, 1975, a single RN and one single LNA covered 31 patients. This was the staffing ratio. This was how bad it was.
Shit.
These were ICU patients. For reference, the standard is one nurse for every 1 to 2 ICU patients. That is the standard of care, say in the state of California. That is the law. ICU level of care, it's one nurse for every 1 to 2 patients. And
was it that standard back then? Do you know? I know that's
the standard
now.
They didn't have standards written into law back then, but that was the goal. That was the staffing goal. That's what ratios should have been.
Right.
But they just didn't have the staff, and they had way too many fucking patients. And that night, an Ann Arbor nurse, the one that had the 31 patients, performed their usual rounds. But they, of course, could not have eyes everywhere all the time. And a little after 10 p.m., the nurse found a patient dead in his hospital bed. Just found him dead. A couple hours prior, he had been seen. He was in good condition. He was fine. He was stable. Everything was fine. But he was found dead with no apparent cause.
So he very well could have been one of the people that coded.
It's thought that he was. Yes. A few minutes later, they're continuing their rounds on their 31 patients. They find another patient who had been stable, now dead.
Man.
Two in the same night. This poor nurse and aide are like, I cannot even imagine the feeling, the helplessness that they're feeling in that moment.
Awful.
So this is between July 1st and then mid-August. Dozens of patients have suddenly stopped breathing, and 10 of them had died. And nobody still had any freaking idea. Everybody was full of questions. Now, Dr. Ann Hill, who I mentioned before, who was the one from Ireland, she's the head of anesthesiology. She finally is like, okay, because anesthesiologists, the anesthesiologists listening know this, they know their medications and they know what class of medications cause exactly what symptoms. And she was putting it together exactly what the presentations were for every one of these patients, what their comorbidities were, what the cascade of events was once they got sick, and what their recovery looked like. And she's thinking, there is no way that these people aren't getting something that they are not supposed to be getting. And if we have done an investigation and we cannot find that there's been an equipment or medication issue, it kind of has to be intentional at this point.
Right,
I don't know what else to do.
Right.
So on August 15th, 1975, Dr. Hill witnessed 3 respiratory arrests that same day. And she, on her own, determined a couple of things. So first of all, each patient had received an IV injection, and a visible adverse reaction emerged within minutes that were all identical across the freaking board to every single other one of these presentations. These reactions were like, all of a sudden, difficulty moving, difficulty breathing, followed by complete respiratory arrest. And then once they get ventilated, they recover at an unusually quick rate. After receiving their emergency care, it's like they kind of wake up and they start breathing again on their own. And it's like nothing ever happened.
Like, hey, what happened?
So all of this just supported the implication that a drug is being administered that is causing them to involuntarily stop breathing based on the symptoms, right? So
did she have a suspicion of what type of drug at this point?
Yeah. So at this point, she's starting to go through drugs that she knows class by class. So she's like, okay, this could be barbiturates, benzodiazepines, opiates like morphine or Demerol, for example, in high enough doses. These things can depress autonomic nervous system to the point that respiratory or difficulty breathing and respiratory arrest can happen. However, it would be unusual for them not to be sleepy, groggy, or have any other symptoms beforehand, like in the minutes after they get that injection, and just stop breathing. So it didn't fit exactly. So she moves on to, okay, what about like muscle relaxants or neuromuscular blocking agents? Mm-hmm. These are drugs that can directly affect those skeletal muscles involved in respiration. And with enough of these medications, someone's breathing muscles can stop completely. Mm-hmm. And it can push them into a respiratory arrest. And the fact that they're short acting supports this too, because it's like in and out of the system and then they're breathing on their own again. Of course, while she's kind
sounds
of narrowing...
Sounds like something that you would give a patient when they're going under anesthesia.
Well, that's the thing. Right? Stay tuned. Exactly. So there's like a... Even within those few classes, there's a lot of medications that could do this, right? So she's just trying to kind of collect data and narrow things down. So a lot of other doctors were kind of sort of still investigating the theory that IV bags were contaminated or there's some kind of pharmacy mix up with what nurses think are in vials and maybe it's something else. They have not been able to find anything to support this, though. So Dr. Hill is kind of going down this rabbit hole of somebody is doing this on purpose. So she's thinking, okay, what if they're being given a paralytic agent? Because we have those, I mean, readily available on the floors for emergencies. Mm-hmm. And one drug that was very commonly used back then was called Pavulon. Now, Pavulon or pancuronium is a muscle relaxant. It is used in anesthesia for paralysis specifically. It is also used in euthanasia of animals, and it is used during lethal injection. It's one of the standard three drugs that are administered for lethal injection in the United States. Now, like all non-depolarizing muscle relaxants, pancuronium has no effect on level of consciousness. This is the most terrifying part. Therefore, if, say, somebody is in surgery and the anesthesia is not sufficient, an individual could, in theory, be awake, but unable to move, unable to cry out, unable to do anything about it due to the effect of the pancuronium.
That now, is terrifying.
There have actually been many civil lawsuits alleging similar issues of inadequate anesthesia during general surgical practices, largely due to improper or insufficient doses of anesthetics in concert with the muscle relaxants. So like people would wake up in surgery but not be able to do anything about it and feel
like
and see everything.
Nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the worst. So it's another one of those medications in the same family as Vecuronium or Rocuronium, which are more commonly used today, but all in the same family. And they will render you completely paralyzed, including your respiratory muscles, and unable to cry out for help, basically. So this is terrifying. That was a terrifying idea for her to have. So Dr. Hill was like, I have a hunch about this. So now there's no shortage of people suffering respiratory arrests. So all she has to do is kind of wait for another one to happen so that she can test her theory. So Dr. Hill waits. And of course, a patient inevitably crashes.
She's going to say, did she have to wait
she's
long?
Ready. No. She did not. This is happening every 2 or 3 days in clusters. So she sees a patient who had just been ventilated and transferred to the ICU. And she tests her theory by giving the antidote to Pavulon. And because all muscle relaxants are risky, they all have a antidote of some kind, or most of them have an antidote of some kind. Now, the antidote for Pavulon is a combination of two anticholinergic drugs, neostigmine and glycopyrrolate. They're both anticholinergics. So lo and behold, she pushes both those meds, the antidote to Pavulon, and the guy fucking wakes up like nothing happened. Lo and behold, it worked immediately.
Thank goodness.
Dr. Hill is like, okay, now I have this really big, really scary piece of information.
Just like, I called that shit. Now what? Yeah.
Who the fuck is doing this? So she brings her findings to Dr. Fryer, the CMO of the hospital, and he quickly determines that this is well beyond his authority. of course, this is And this is a federally owned building. So this is now, this is a case for the FBI, says Kris Jenner. So immediately he notifies the police, who then turn it directly over to the FBI because a federally owned operation, this is their jurisdiction. So they start forming a task force for this and they arrive. And as soon as the FBI starts roaming the halls of this hospital, the respiratory arrests just stop.
No shit.
Bam, they stop. So
people are watching.
It seems like the whoever the killer was like, well, I guess that closes that door. Don't want to do that. So the FBI agents that were there interviewed like everybody at the hospital. It seemed like hundreds of people. And everybody from janitorial staff to the CMO himself, everybody got spoken to. And they actually ended up, of those bodies that had already been buried, they ended up exhuming some of the suspected victims who had died because of the report that they had heard from Dr. Ann Hill, who had said that I have a theory that they're all being given pancuronium because this antidote worked. So they started pulling the ICU schedules to look for patterns, who was on duty when the emergencies occurred and whatnot. And the most damning information, though, came from the people that survived their ordeals because they remembered, you know, the few minutes before everything happened to them. Now, one guy who we're going to call Joe, on August 15th, Joe sat in his hospital bed, also trying to, you know, sort of figure out in his own head what the hell is going on, like trying to reconcile this whole thing, right? He was only 49. And he's, after his stay in the ICU, he's still kind of trying to recover from, like, being intubated. He's otherwise doing fine. It's just really, like, the prolonged hospitalization, right? Now, at the foot of his bed, Dr. Lucy Goodenday was there, and she was one of the doctors that had helped resuscitate him. He was actually still intubated at the time, so he couldn't really talk, but he was awake. He was doing well. And she's like, if you could nod or shake your head when I ask questions, that would be great. And she started asking him a few questions about the few minutes before. She said, did you receive any medication before all of this happened? And he nodded his head, yes. And did you remember who gave you the medication? He nodded again. He said, yes. She said, do you know their name? Again, he nodded, yes. And with
closer.
This, Dr. Goodenday handed him a pen and said, if you're willing, are you able to recall the name? And he wrote on the piece of paper the name Pia, P-I-A. Now, Pia was actually the nickname of 29-year-old Filipina Narciso, one of the nurses that had emigrated from the Philippines that we talked about. She went by Pia. So the FBI took this and just fucking ran. They found that nearly all of the poisonings did coincide with Narciso's shifts. So didn't bode well for her.
No.
No, she's not the only one in the hospital, but that did not bode well for her.
Yeah.
Now, when Narciso entered the room for the victim to ID a couple days after he'd recovered, he immediately recognized her. But as authorities were ready to sort of zero in, a new witness account ended up surfacing. Another victim faintly recalled someone entering his room and injecting his IV with a substance shortly before his event. And to help him remember details, the FBI brought in a psychiatrist, Dr. Herbert Spiegel, to place the patient under hypnosis to help him retrieve memories of the night of the attack. Now, we know today that hypnosis is very controversial and is not going to reveal the exact truth like much of the time. But at the time, the FBI actually considered it a valid method of helping victims remember things, which I did not know that they used this routinely as like a police tool. I don't know.
That's interesting.
It is. Now, perhaps they expected the guy to describe Filipino Narciso as the nurse who had come in and put a substance in his IV, but he actually identified 30-year-old Leonora Perez, who was her friend, the other young Filipino immigrant nurse who had just started working there. Now, again, it remains very unclear how reliable this was. This was under hypnosis. And also, racial bias is,
right,
you know, is something that's very real. And I hate to say it, but, you know, there are some people that, you know, that certain races to other races, they say all look alike. And it's a very real right. thing to for some people. So it's hard to say, you know, how much of that is even valuable. Now, as Filipinos in Michigan, Narciso and Perez didn't, you know, exactly have the easiest time while moving there because much of the white American middle class carried a pretty significant racial bias against Asian Americans going back to World War II. As you said, you know, the U.S. government had long upheld, you know, this prejudice against people of Asian descent, and internment camps incarcerated Japanese Americans during World War II. And there were exclusionary policies banning Asian immigration and naturalization multiple times in the 1800s and 1900s. And there were regulations that left many U.S. citizens to sit in the comfort of their own privilege, seeing Asians as like these outsiders that would just never, you know, be able to actually be a part of the community. So even in the 1970s, Narciso and Perez faced language. First of all, the language barrier, you know, made it tough for any makes it tough for anybody. Then they had limited access to affordable housing because they were who they were and people were racist back then. And then joining the workforce, which is, you know, while thankfully they were nurses and could, you know, join workforce programs like this. But the veterans that they cared for had spent years fighting wars against people of Asian descent, whether it be in Japan, Korea, or the latest war in Vietnam. They were essentially being trained to see anybody who looked like Narciso or Perez as enemies, right? And all of this was raising the question, were these two women just being railroaded because of their race? And like the FBI stood by the fact that when that third victim, when a third victim identified Perez, he chose her out of a lineup of 18 women where 15 of women in there were Asian. The FBI was also under a lot of pressure at the time, because they had just absolutely fumbled the Patty Hearst kidnapping case, and they had really shitty PR at the time, and they needed
a
win big time.
They needed a W.
They needed a big dub. So they were ready to just like pin this on Narciso and Perez as like prime suspects. They were getting zeroed in on. And the nurses were both pulled from direct patient care, and the investigation continued. Now, both women were probably fucking terrified because they're in this country that they're not that familiar with. They just wanted to go to work and provide for their families and were working in terrible conditions. And this happens. Now, Narciso accepted an administrative role at the hospital. She was not allowed to care for patients, but in the interim was able to do sort of ancillary things. And meanwhile, Perez actually was like, fuck this. And she up and moved to Chicago and she looked for work at another VA hospital out there. And meanwhile, from August to October of 1975, the FBI thoroughly reviewed every medical record and continued interviewing all the victims, all the patients, all the staff. But all of the leads, Everybody started pointing fingers and looking at Narciso and Perez because they just had nothing else on anybody. And they didn't think that the women's stories added up. And that fall, Filipina Narciso and Leonora Perez were subpoenaed to appear in front of a federal grand jury in Detroit, Michigan. And both women the entire time maintained their innocence, but nobody was listening. And the pair were formally indicted on June 16th, 1976, for 5 counts of murder, 10 counts of poisoning, and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. When they were arrested, the story just absolutely took off. This was the talk of the water cooler, baby. Yeah.
Headlines.
The media tumbled into like this partisan frenzy, though, because there were a lot of activist groups speaking out against this type of racism at the time. And immediately they were like, I'm on your side, girls. Like, you're being labeled because people are racist. And I don't think you did this. And try and convince me otherwise, basically. And they were all convinced and being very vocal about the fact that the Bureau is rushing. Sorry, go ahead.
But so far, without concrete proof that they've done it, they do have that you're on every shift that there's a code.
That's true.
You're on it. And a patient has identified you.
Yes.
Like, so it's not like that they just, like, pulled these two out of thin air.
No, it's not. You know? Like, they definitely had circumstantial evidence, but it was very loose circumstantial evidence at
best. Yeah, like, they don't have, like, yeah, I can convict you off of this,
yeah.
But, like, why they're being suspects for
there
sure.
There was no smoking gun. There was no smoking gun whatsoever. So, and these ladies had very few resources. Like, they were both immigrants that were there on work visas. So they had to now navigate in the 70s. They now had to navigate, you know, going to get a lawyer and like the American judicial system, which is a nightmare. And so all of these headlines from both sides are just breaking everywhere. And the eyes of the nation were on this. And allegedly during an FBI interview, one of the patients that received the drug referred to Narciso and Perez with racial slurs, furthering the theory that racial bias definitely influenced all of these identifications. Additionally, it seemed that Narciso and Perez were both questioned without translators, even though neither of them were native English speaking. So they just were thrown to the wolves and hope for the best.
That's not nice.
This is a high-pressure situation for these ladies, and they're speaking a second language that they barely know. Like, that could explain, if there were inconsistencies in their stories, that explains it right there. Like, you can't prove that they even understood the questions that were being asked of them.
Correct.
And then one of the men who had gone on record accusing Narciso and Perez died before the start of the trial from unrelated issues. But the prosecution had videotaped a deposition from another eyewitness. They ultimately decided to drop this guy's name from the indictment altogether. So that's why there's fewer counts of murder and poisoning. Some experts later suggested this was because, you know, of all of the inconsistencies and that because of the inconsistencies of this guy's testimony and the girl's testimony, the FBI is like, this might hurt our case, so we're just gonna not include this guy. We're just not gonna include it. Because we don't want to make it look bad. We want all this very circumstantial evidence to be airtight. Like, dude. So they had to go with what they had. And now jury selection for the US versus Narciso and Perez begins on March 1st, 1977. And the FBI went into this fucking confident AF until March 13th of 1977. This was 2 weeks into the early parts of the court proceedings. The Detroit Free Press reported a confession to the Ann Arbor VA murders from another nurse. Her name was Betty Yu Kim, and she had worked as a nursing supervisor at the Ann Arbor VA hospital in February of 1977. She had admitted to her psychiatrist that she was the Ann Arbor VA murderer. She claimed that the guilt of watching her subordinates take the fall was way too much, and she had to tell somebody.
What?
And very shortly after she made that claim to her psychiatrist, she died by suicide.
Stop.
Yep.
Shit.
Now, one would think that
this would... I did not expect that to come out.
One would think that this would just absolutely crumble whatever case that they had, right? So the news went crazy with this. It set activists completely off the charts. Everybody was freaking the hell out for these ladies. Somebody else confessed to this. Why are these people...
And then killed themselves.
And then killed themselves. So Narciso and Perez were still being tried for the murders. The proceedings did not stop. And on June 16th of 1977, a new witness testimony only further stoked those fires. Because there was a patient at the Ann Arbor VA that claimed that he had seen a man wearing a green surgical gown enter his hospital room on August 15th of 1975. And then he awoke to that same man pulling at his IV and within minutes lost the ability to breathe.
Jesus.
Other witnesses also reportedly claimed to have seen a male figure in green gear standing near patients who had respiratory arrests soon after. Though Narciso and Perez filed a motion to dismiss the case, it was denied.
Oh, damn. Jesus.
The trial proceeded through July 1977, and after 15 days of deliberation, the grand jury declared 31-year-old Filipina Narciso and 33-year-old Leonora Perez guilty of poisoning and conspiring to poison patients.
Shut up.
They each faced a potential life sentence. Now, story's not over, thankfully. While they waited for the sentencing date to arrive, Narciso and Perez demanded a retrial. Defense attorneys claimed that the women had been victimized by the most outrageous grand jury process on record. This was insane. And activists started circulating a petition and marched at the courthouses. They were going to Washington. There were all these protests happening. And eventually, the pressure from the public was starting to work. And in December of 1977, the judge ordered a new trial. But when the new U.S. attorney reviewed the case in early 1978, he decided that there was insufficient evidence for a retrial. So Narciso and Perez were finally freed at that point.
Okay, good for him, first of all.
For looking at this and going, this doesn't fucking make sense.
We shouldn't have even gotten there. Right?
Why did we even get where we went? And no, we will not be doing this again. So both those ladies finally were able to put everything behind them after that. However, even after the reports of the man being seen, no other suspects were pursued ever. It's possible that Betty Yu Kim did commit the crimes, the lady that had died by suicide after she told her psychiatrist.
Maybe they looked into her, or maybe they did. Yeah.
You know. But they also, there was never really a whole lot of investigation into the reports of a man in green being seen with all these patients. And officially, the murders remain unsolved, and their families who survived the attacks have never seen justice.
My gosh, that's devastating.
I wonder, like, how this would have happened in modern times. First of all, it would have been almost impossible to get away with because we leave a digital footprint with everything we do now.
Yeah, and everything's counted.
Yeah, yeah. You can't do this shit anymore, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say, you know, exactly who did this. But
I can see where you were drawing the link with obviously what we just covered, you know, as far as the activism and everything.
Exactly. I think racial bias, unfortunately, played a huge role in their condemnation and their conviction. And it's really sad that they had to go through that. God bless America for these poor women that just came here looking for a fucking better life. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
These poor, you know, migrant nurses who are just trying to find a better life. And
right.
After their releases, Narciso and Perez each sort of like quietly just started new lives. They did both continue on in nursing. And in 1980, they both became legal full U.S. citizens, which is amazing. And had this case not been so publicized, they could still be in prison for this.
Right.
If this didn't get the attention because of the activists, like, can you imagine? These two ladies would just have died in prison. for crimes that they did not commit. How wild is that?
That's crazy.
I know. And that's the story.
And she's sticking to it.
I'm fucking sticking to it. I just thought that was such a...
I'm at least a happy ending for those two.
Not so much for the victims who never saw justice. Mm-hmm. And we still have no idea. Like, you know what I mean? Genuinely. I mean, we have some ideas, yes, but we don't have anything concrete, unfortunately, right, with what happened to those people.
Ooh, that's wild.
I know it.
Such similarities, too. Thank you for, like, that's a good way to, like, transition out of the high-profile case that we just talked, you know, discussed for a month. You know what
I
mean?
I'm ready to put that to bed. I'm ready to stop talking about Lindsay Clancy.
Unfortunately, as we all have learned on Friday, that's not going to happen yet.
I know. We're going to get a whole nother round of this. So we'll bring it to you as it comes. Don't you worry.
All right, guys, thank you for listening. You can check us out on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can find us on YouTube at Med Crimes Podcast.
Search for us on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you want to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast.
If you want to check out, if you want to send us any crazy stories, suggestions, anything you want to say, just say hi. Get ready for our next episode of Break Grim Banter, which will be here before you know it. You can check us out at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe out there, y'all.